We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we interview cult filmmaker Jeff Krulik, known for his rock fan documentary, Heavy Metal Parking Lot. We also talk to one of the authors of the blog, This Is Why You're Fat, a collection of culinary monstrosities. We'll have those features and more, this time on Sidetrack. Hey. In Three Card Monty, con artists use swift hand moves and constant patter to convince a sucker there's a way to win. It is street theater designed to keep its losers entertained. We find more about this quote-unquote game from independent producer Sally Herships.
It's my job to hide it, yours to find it. I'm a little baby Yosa now. Watch the ball.
When he was a kid, Alex Stone totally fell for the three-card Monty.
I remember exactly that. I remember, like, it was yesterday, like, just, I couldn't believe it. I lost, like, you know, like, my whole month's allowance.
Needless to say, the experience stuck in his head. Now, years later, Stone is a magician, a master of sleight of hand, and he's infiltrated a Monty mob, the group that runs the scam. Let me clarify. Stone isn't a criminal. He's studying what he and other performers consider an art form. He admits watching makes him feel guilty, but he sees the player's skill and some things other people don't.
And one of the things that people don't understand about the Monty is it's not just one person. There's usually about 6 to 8 people in a mob.
There's the point guy, a lookout.
And then you've got a handful of shills.
There's the operator.
A guy with big glasses on, or sometimes I'll even pretend like he's partly blind or drunk.
And sometimes there'll be a guy called a soother to soothe the sting of being burned if you lose.
Oh, yeah, they got me too. Can't call the cops though, right? That, you know, so there's that.
But there's something else too. Stone says the Monty is actually a kind of theater. After all, there's a big cast, and everyone plays their part.
They have to be. I mean, they have to be performers.
Catherine Sheehy is a theater professor at Yale.
They have to be performers, or you won't stop to watch. They'd be out of business. They have to create a performance so seamless that you don't know you're participating in the performance.
There's a long tradition of crime and street theater going together.
To be an actor was pretty much always, at least in Western culture, to be just this side of lawless. It goes way far back.
To the Italian Renaissance and the Commedia dell'arte, a kind of early Italian improv troupe who was in trouble with the church.
Who couldn't decide whether it was worse to be having these performances indoors, which were sacrilegious, or outdoors, you know, because crime was just rampant. There was crime on stage and there was crime in the audience.
The criminals and actors were in cahoots. So during one of these Commedia performances, while the audience's eyes were watching rubes get pickpocketed and fooled on stage, their pockets were being picked, and oftentimes it was off-duty actors doing the picking. And speaking of crime and audiences, all right, do I have
check,
you?
Check, check. Yes, here I am.
That's someone we'll call Brian. It's not his real name, but it's what we're going to use because...
Well, I play three-card Monty in the shell game for money.
Brian agreed to tell me about the Monty from his perspective. And since he couldn't exactly invite me to watch him work, he sent me a video. It's a little rough, but listen closely.
B, where's the ball at now? Watch it. Win here. The bigger I bet, the scarier y'all get. 200 wins, 4. Watch the ball and get some more. Win, lose.
It's from the Bonnaroo Music Festival a couple years ago. Those are the guys we heard at the beginning of the story. Brian's mob works exactly like Alex Stone told us it would.
If you got your lookout, you got the operator, and then you've got shills or sticks. I mean, you've got different names, shills and sticks.
Do you get kind of a performer's high from doing this?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. When they're all laughing and they're losing their money at the same time and they leave laughing, there's no better feeling in the world than that.
What does it feel like?
Oh, I don't know. You get that adrenaline rush, sort of a light feeling in your head.
There was only one problem with talking to Brian. Your job is to essentially steal money, right?
Well, not really, no. I wouldn't call it stealing.
Brian also tried to tell me it's possible to win when betting on the Monty. So wait a second, you're telling me now that it is actually possible to win this game?
It is possible. It is possible.
I have to ask you one question. Your job is to con people, right?
Right.
So how do I know I can believe you now?
Well, you don't, of course. But I'm the only person who does this sort of work who's going to talk to you. So you can take it, you know, you can take it for what it is.
The Monty ropes people in. Admit it, you're fascinated. I know I am. But it's not just shady Monty mobs. You can see this at a ballpark, too. Catherine Sheehy told me this story.
I was at Yankee Stadium, and they have this tradition at Yankee Stadium where they put, you know, a little ping pong ball under one of three little Yankee batting helmets.
This is on the Jumbotron.
And it's kind of like, find the ping pong ball. Which is the ping pong ball under? And then the crowd shouts, it's A or it's B or it's C, which is ridiculous because it could be anywhere. There is no actual ping pong ball and there are no actual hats covering it. But there are 70,000 of us all going, it's A, it's under A. I'm sure I was watching it closely.
Why do we keep playing? Why do something so foolish? What is it about our brain that lets us think it's okay to play?
It's because the brain, the perception of visual cues in the brain actually lags behind reality by a small but finite amount of time.
That's Alex Stone, the guy who's studying the Monty. He's also a physicist, and he's writing a book about the intersections between magic, crime, and science. We're not fast enough to follow the ping pong ball. Our brains cannot keep up with reality.
Your brain actually sees in snapshots. Time only appears as this continuous linear stream, the strand of consciousness, after your brain fills in the gaps.
In neuroscience, this phenomenon is known as persistence of vision, and it's the reason a movie works. But it's also the reason we don't always see things as they actually are.
We literally become blind to certain things. We literally do not see certain things that happen before us.
This is what the con artist counts on. He'll try to distract you so you're slow to catch up. And those milliseconds of delay, that's what the Monty depends on. But then there's the theater of it.
You know, it's one thing to steal someone's, you know, to hold someone up and steal their purse. It's another thing to convince someone to give you their money and then sort of walk away without pressing charges, which is what these people do.
It's designed so that people will lose money and still be happy. And it's been doing it for 3,000 years, at least.
But now that I know how it works, next time I'm sure I can win.
That feature from independent producer Sally Herships. This is Sidetrack. Recently, fans of WILL brought to our attention a crossword puzzle from September from famed puzzle creator Merle Riegel. If you don't know him, Riegel is the Sunday crossword creator for the Washington Post, the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and many other papers. Riegel has also appeared on Oprah and was featured in the movie Wordplay. I called him up recently and found out more about this particular puzzle. On your September 13th puzzle, 10 down was where to hear all things considered. The answer was NPR. And 69 across was its down 10 station is WILL.
It's and, 10 down station, yeah.
Yeah, referring to the previous clue.
Right.
The answer is Champaign-Urbana.
Exactly.
How did you come up with these?
Well, I mean, it's part of a famous song called See You in September. I figured since this was the September puzzle, and I've known that song for years and years, it sounds like you're saying, see you in September, but in puzzles, you know, we always have something else up our sleeves, and so I'm thinking of the letters C and U. So this whole puzzle was about the letter, about things that have the initials C-U, and Champaign-Urbana is a nice long one, and it's exactly 15 letters, and it went right across the middle. But it's kind of surprising that there are lots of other ones, too, like Cry's Uncle is C-U, Cocktail Umbrella is a C and a U, Come Unglued, Cornell University, you know, Conduct Unbecoming. And I always save the oddest one for last. I usually, like, assume that people are solving from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing they solve at the bottom right will be, like, the point, and I have carbon unit down there, which is how humans are usually described in sci-fi movies.
Well, Champaign-Urbana is right there in the middle of the puzzle. How did you come to know WILL and Champaign-Urbana and use them in your puzzle?
Well, there aren't too many radio stations that actually spell words. I mean, wind, will, I mean, there's only a handful of them. And the fact that that WILL is also, you know, just it's a proper name, it's a regular word. I mean, it's just, I just thought it would be a cute way to do it. I mean, I could have said, you know, city and, you know, two cities in Illinois, but I didn't want to, you know, I figured that once people got the hang of this idea of all the CUs, then once they got down to the middle, they pretty much know what's going on, and to do anything that's a little too clear would be a gimme. So I thought I'll just do some interesting trivia about it, which when they get it, they'll understand it like Jeopardy does. You know, once they see W-I-L-L, I get it, because the I-L-L is Illinois. See, so they had like a way of check. Once they got the answer, they would see what the connection was.
Have you ever been to Champaign-Urbana?
No, I don't think so. Not consciously. Although I've been to Chicago when I was on Oprah, when I was in Chicago to be on Oprah. But that was a tie-in with wordplay, because they did a show called How Do They Do That? And I was just on the show. They didn't really ask us exactly how we did it, but I did make a big O-shaped crossword puzzle for her and the audience to solve.
Wow.
It's all about her, obviously.
Now, according to your article on Wikipedia, or the article about you on Wikipedia, you made your first crossword when you were 6 and sold a puzzle to the New York Times at age 16.
That's correct.
Wow. What drew you to crossword puzzles at such a young age?
I was a big fan of building sets when I was a little kid, like Tinker Toys and Lincoln Logs. And when I found out what words were, I just did the exact same thing. I mean, fortunately, someone actually gave me grid paper, I think probably just to shut me up for a while. And so I just sat there, and I just made these little word structures in the grid. And I have no idea why. There's nobody in my entire family that's like me. I think I'm legit, but I've always wondered. And then when I got to be maybe 8 or 9 or 10, and I was making pretty much regular crossword puzzles like you would see in newspapers, and but it never occurred to me to actually send them in until I was in journalism class when I was in high school, and my teacher said, you know, you're making puzzles like I see in the paper. You should just send them to the New York Times. And so when I was 15, I sent one to the New York Times, and got published when I was 16.
Wow.
And then for the longest time, for about 10, 15 years, I was the youngest ever. Now a bunch of whippersnappers have come along and sort of iced me out.
So what's the hardest part about making a crossword?
Boy, there's no, I mean, the whole process is pretty much just fun. I mean, there's no, for me, there's no hard part. The most fun part is thinking of the themes. And, you know, it's after you think of a theme, I mean, Hitchcock once said that he loves planning the movie out, but when he actually has to shoot it, that's no fun for him. And to some degree, that's the deal with me and puzzles. I like thinking of the themes. I like making the puzzle itself. Cluing is can be kind of drudgy, you know. But in general, you know, where the theme ideas come from, because my themes are kind of on the gag-oriented side. And so I'll be watching, you know, TV, and I'll see the thing about, like, well, let's say how cavemen are really kind of sensitive these days. If there really were cavemen in the workplace, what kinds of things would you not have to say? You know, like, you would never refer to the local bar as a local watering hole. You wouldn't want to do that. You would never want to say, you never want to mention rock music. You would never want to say, I had to drag my wife to a game last night. You know, so I gather. You wouldn't want to say that. So, I mean, ideas for puzzles, that's the most fun, is thinking of the themes. And then weaving them through the puzzle is like, that's just as much fun, because that's the actual constructing process. Actually cluing it once you're all done, the theme answers are fun to clue. But what's called the fill, which is the whole rest of the puzzle, since a lot of words come up kind of a lot and repeatedly, it can be like a little bit unfun.
Well, here is to more great crossword puzzles, and maybe you'll slip in more references to WILL and NPR and public radio.
I don't see any reason why I shouldn't, especially since the word will comes up all the time in puzzles.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was crossword puzzle creator Merle Regal. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Freak shows, once popular in the late 19th and early 20th century, are seeing a revival. Even though modern medicine and human enhancement technologies has the potential to erase the so-called freak, independent producer Brianna O'Higgins found a group of self-described freaks who think they are just fine.
It's really hard to see.
Yeah. H.E.A. Burns holds up an x-ray of her right hand.
You can see how, like, there's no formation of other ones. It's just really clear cut and simple.
She hasn't always been so open to showing off her hand, especially not graphic pictures of her bone structure.
There was a stigma, like, I was insecure about hanging out with the people I really was, you know, interested in and wanted to be around and enjoyed their company. I was ashamed to be different.
Growing up in Akron, Ohio, HEA hid her hand in her sleeve and avoided shaking hands at all costs. In addition, she avoided anyone else who was a little different. She didn't want to draw attention to her abnormality.
I didn't want to be grouped into that. I didn't want to be like, oh, look, all the freaks are hanging out together. I don't know. That started pretty young. I guess I was probably 11 when I was feeling that way. And then throughout into high school, people just gradually got more and more, you know, it's their own insecurities, and it's their own idea of normal.
Southwest of Akron, outside of Cincinnati, Elizabeth Anderson also grew up insecure, but her difference was harder to hide.
I was special ed growing up, and I felt like I was always being stared at. I was always being on display, even though my body is ostensibly normal, my mind is not. And when we were in special ed, we were paraded through the cafeteria into the lunch line to get our food, and then paraded back out of the cafeteria with our trays back out to the separate building where special ed classes were housed, and I always felt like I was on display.
By the time Elizabeth entered high school, she was no longer in the special education class.
I would see the special ed kids at my high school, and a lot of them were severely disabled, and people would just gawk at them, and their head would swivel, you know, 180 degrees as they watched the special ed line walk past, and I would think, why do we stare? Why is it not okay to stare? What's different between me staring at them and them staring and other people staring at me when I was a child?
The dwarfs are getting taller. The fat lady's getting thin.
Well, there have been freak shows ever since there's been a currency and an economy. People have found that the public would pay to see someone who was different.
Tell me what ever happened to the pinheads? Are they locked up in some dungeon far out of sight? Well, once they ballied for Barnum.
Today, HEA and Elizabeth are both members of the 999 Eyes Freak Show out of Austin, Texas, a 21st century take on the American freak shows of the 19th and 20th centuries. HEA was spotted by two freak show revivalists in a coffee shop.
I consider myself one of the founding freaks. I was the first freak. I met Samantha and Dylan, who had conceived the idea of having a freak show museum, but without the knowing that you can do it with real humans. It had been so long since there had been a freak show, and when they met me and saw my claw, then they realized, oh, well, they're still out there.
HEA performs as the Lobster Girl. Her hand, with only two digits, looks similar to a lobster claw. And Elizabeth paints the banners and sets and serves as a medical and historical consultant.
I started studying freaks when I was 14. I have Asperger's, and that was one of my obsessive interests. There's evidence of people with, usually babies with disabilities, being shown in Roman times and up through the Middle Ages, up through the Renaissance. We sort of think of the freak show as we know it being associated with P.T. Barnum and being started in the 1840s, but really it was going on long before that. The association of the freak show with the circus was mostly a 19th century thing, but before that, in the 17th, 18th centuries, you could find people with dwarfism or giantism, conjoined twins, really anyone that was had an unusual body, you could find them exhibiting themselves in pubs and in public squares and sometimes even in private homes.
I mean, the freak show was the bread and butter of the circus. I mean, it was they were the stars, the freaks.
Hurry, hurry, step this way, the strangest sight from the island. Freaks from the four corners of the world. What, two nickels, one dime, a tenth part of a dollar. We've got the show.
They were sitting pretty. The showmen knew that they were not going to find a four-legged woman anywhere else, a hairy-faced boy. Like, they treated these people like royalty. And they were, kings and queens were their audience. They were brought all around the world, were able to support themselves and really make a living by showing their uniqueness. And it's something that welfare just can't provide, you know, for these people who otherwise couldn't hold a regular job.
The American Freak Show was pretty much non-existent by the mid-1970s. Though the freaks were generally well-paid and well-treated, society was changing.
People are quick to blame what they consider political correctness and the idea that disabled people were being exploited by being exhibited. And that's certainly part of it.
Yeah, political correctness is definitely one. But what when you have people who are not disabled advocating for the quote-unquote disabled, I think there just became a lot of controversy sprung up from that. The picture shows, you know, all of that really had a lot to do with the decline.
There's so much to stimulate us nowadays. Why would you go to pay to look at someone basically just stand there, which is what a lot of the original freaks would do? And there's also the idea that of equality for disabled people means that they can go out and seek normal, you know, so-called respectable jobs, and so now you don't have to pay to see someone with a disability, a dwarf or giant, someone in a wheelchair, because they're all around us. They're not shut away anymore, and I think that's a great thing. But of course, the problem is that some of them want to be able to be performers and show off their bodies in the way that the old-time freaks did.
Right here in the United States, in three states today, freak shows are still illegal. In the 1970s and 80s, freaks all over the country were arrested for exhibiting themselves. Their charges? Freak pornography.
999 Eyes is a bit different from the old-time freak shows. Instead of lecturing on the exoticism or feeble-mindedness of the freaks lecture about themselves.
There's a man who has neurofibromatosis and his face is very deformed, and he started this whole campaign that the slogan is, "Don't stare, just ask."
It's hereditary. Well, can you split? No, that means I got it from my parents.
And so he encourages people to ask him about why his face looks the way it does rather than just gawk at him. And I think that that's really important in opening a dialogue about disability and why some bodies are privileged and others are not, and why, you know, we only see people that are, we only see women that are 6 feet tall and 120 pounds on fashion runways, and why we only see people that are look a certain way on the news, for instance. And I think that a very important step in challenging that is to make it okay to look at people that are different and to make it okay to appreciate people that are different.
We really do touch people. This one instance that's just so unforgettable is this fella came to our show in Seattle, Washington one night, and we didn't meet him. We didn't hear anything about him. But the next day we performed at the same venue. And he came back and brought his mother. His mother had neurofibromatosis, and he introduced her to us. And he said, "Mom," he said to her, "Mom, I've been ashamed of you all my life." And he thanked us for just making him see a different side of it, to perceive it a different way, to see it as a thing of beauty.
When I was a child, sympathy won't get you anywhere. No, don't avert your eyes. Open them instead. 'Cause I'm a beaver.
That feature from independent producer Brianna O'Higgins. Still to come, we find out if food really is better deep fried and covered in bacon. And documentary filmmaker Jeff Krulik, the man behind Heavy Metal Parking Lot. Stay tuned. Giant hamburgers, food wrapped in bacon, strange things deep fried. It seems when it comes to food creations, someone is always out there trying to come up with the biggest, fattiest, most decadent creations. There is now a blog dedicated to such items. It's called This Is Why You're Fat, and it's a collection of culinary monstrosities, such as the 29,559-calorie sandwich, bacon apple pie, and mini football stadiums made of snack foods. Jessica Amason and Richard Blakely are the founders of this blog. They have just released a book based on the site, This Is Why You're Fat, Where Dreams Become Heart Attacks. It's published by Harper Studio. I recently talked with Amason and asked her how the site got started.
Well, my partner and I both worked in new media, and so we were very in touch with web trends, total web nerds, and we started to notice a trend with gross food on the web. There are a ton of sites devoted to bacon, and there are sites like Pimp That Snack and Serious Eats that are just all about kind of, you know, over-the-top food. And that became pretty, that had sort of reached critical mass, and it made sense to create a site devoted just to that and build a community around it.
Well, you know, I would go to county fairs and I would see the deep-fried Snickers, and I thought that was decadent. But then I see things on your site, and what I thought was crazy is downright pedestrian.
I know. There's almost a competitive element inherent to these items. You know, if somebody makes this really innovative, crazy thing, like the snack stadium, for example, made out of different kinds of snack foods, like Twinkies, and there's guacamole as the field, and potato chips, and all kinds of stuff. We actually receive a number of versions of the snack stadium with people trying to one-up each other and make the ultimate snack stadium. So there's, you know, there's definitely a lot of competition in this world for fatty foods.
I think one of the classic ones people might be familiar with is the Luther, the cheeseburger that instead of buns, it's Krispy Kreme donuts.
Right, right.
That seems
and
a classic
one. That was actually named after Luther Vandross, the singer.
But nowadays, everything that's on your site is that, and then it's deep fried and covered in bacon and then deep fried again.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, people are always thinking about how to push the envelope. We do actually have in the book that is out this week based on the blog, we do have a whole section devoted to fried snack foods. We actually had to pick one kind of food because there are just so many deep fried things out there.
So there seems to be a strange mix on your website of disgust and celebration and one-upsmanship all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
How can you explain that? How can you get those different thoughts together?
Well, I think that when we launched the site, we really wanted to make sure that we kept it pretty neutral. And by that, I just mean nice and simple, just the photos, a funny, you know, caption and a descriptor of the items, you know, and the link to the source. That's it. And we did that because you're right. I mean, people respond to these images differently. Some people think it's like aversion therapy, you know, for dieting and what not to do. And some people think it's hilarious. Some people think it's a great response to the whole organic food movement and the diet movement. We kept it simple so that these images could really speak for themselves.
Was there ever anything that was too much for you, anything that crossed the line? And I'm thinking of one thing in particular, the meat baby.
I thought you were going to say that one.
Yeah, does that one cross the line for you? And explain what this meat baby is.
Well, okay, so the meat baby is exactly what it sounds like. It is ground beef formed into the shape of a baby. It has a bacon diaper on it. And it's definitely disturbing because you don't really want to think of your food, you know, as a baby and look, you know, make it look like a baby. But it was also kind of hilarious, and just that somebody would even think to do that, cook it, and then actually eat it. We actually have a site or a section in the book based on these kinds of things that come to the site that is meat creations. So there is a meat house, a meat tank, a meat ship. Apparently, you know, playing with your food and molding it into different shapes is a pretty big deal. So we couldn't deny that one. It was too good.
So where do you go from here? You know, if things have been, you know, pizzas have been folded in half and deep fried and made into tacos, where do you go? Where do you go from here?
Well, you know, it's funny because we were a little worried for a while. We thought, gosh, you know, we might run out of content. And, you know, what do we do in that situation when you just can't make anything fattier and crazier? And people continue to deliver. I have to give a shout out to all the fans. I mean, they're so inventive and a little bit crazy, but we love them for that. And so we still have tons of content coming in. We have the book coming out this week, and then we're actually in talks about possibly doing another kind of adaptation for the brand, maybe TV.
Wow. Well, you know that Thanksgiving is not too far away. It's right around the corner. Maybe is there a suggestion you might have for that that Thanksgiving dish that would be the showstopper, that would be based on something that's been on the website or something that you know of, you know, a quick recipe, a quick instruction on how to make just something for your Thanksgiving table?
Well, we actually have a number of Thanksgiving-themed items that we plan to roll out on the site pretty soon. We've kind of been holding on to them. One item that was actually my partner's favorite is something called the sweet pea potato pie. And that is basically your standard sweet potato pie, but instead of that marshmallow crust that a lot of people put on it, you use Easter Peeps, the sugar-coated, colored sprinkle marshmallow peeps.
Wow.
And that creates kind of a rainbowy, fatty crust.
Well, there you go. There's your Thanksgiving dish right there. So if people want to check out this site for themselves and learn more about what we've been talking about, where should they go?
They should go to thisiswhyyourfat.com. And then you can actually click on the button at the top of the site to find out more information about where you can get the book.
That was Jessica Amason, who, along with Richard Blakely, run the blog This Is Why You're Fat. You're listening to Sidetrack. No matter how many quirky subjects he comes across, a cult documentary filmmaker from Maryland says he'll probably always be best known for an hour he spent interviewing long-haired teenagers before a Judas Priest concert nearly 25 years ago. And Jeff Krulik says that suits him just fine. Jeff Bossert spoke with the creator of Heavy Metal Parking Lot on a career that was founded in public access TV and resurrected through home video and, more recently, the internet.
You started out making this little niche for yourself with off-the-wall documentaries. Is there one key moment that got that all started for you?
I can't really trace it to one key moment necessarily, but, you know, I guess it's a whole combination of things. I wanted to, always was drawn to offbeat subjects and subcultures and just general weirdness. I mean, ever since I was young, you know, I was always a collector and always into pop culture. and always trying to read more adult material, if you will. Then young adult section always appealed to me more than the kids section. And then, of course, the adult, I'm talking the library, you know, just whatever windows of the world you could find back in the 60s and 70s, I was there. But as far as making films or doing television or video or documentary in this arena, it just seemed like a logical progression for me, especially after the college radio experience is what I cite as a prime influence on me. I was in college radio when I went to the University of Maryland. I was there in 1979 and, you know, spent 4 years working at the college radio station, which was a free-form, anything-goes 10-watt channel. But it was our 10-watt channel, and we really programmed it like it was heard by many persons. We kind of molded it in the image we wanted. Now, I wanted to work in radio and even wanted to work in the record industry. Neither of those opportunities panned out because I realized I wouldn't be able to carry the college alternative spirit into that. The stuff that I liked was not commercially viable. So I wound up getting turned on to community television, public access, which I realized was a chance to get behind a camera and do the same kind of things I was doing on college radio. And so that's where I just kind of was turned loose. I learned you know, video and filmmaking and developed an eye and never looked back.
And you developed a collaboration with someone who'd had some major film experience, who had worked with John Waters.
John Hine is a dear, close friend. Not the John Hine who started Jump the Shark. Another John Hine. From Baltimore, and I attended Northwestern, actually, and I met him in the mid-80s when I was actually running this community television public access studio 2 years out of college. John and I met up because we had a mutual interest in old movie theaters, and he had made a short film, and I was making a video about the old movie palaces of Washington, D.C. John had been a production assistant on John Waters' film Polyester, and we both love John Waters, and he's a great influence on us, and so John actually worked with him, but we started to become friends and then collaborate, and one of our earliest collaborations was Heavy Metal Parking Lot in 1986.
You're the first number one!
This idea, was it John's, was it yours? And
well, actually, I give full credit to John for coming up with the idea to go to the a parking lot of a heavy metal concert and just wander around, because I had access to equipment and to the gear, professional gear. I took the equipment from my public access studio, and then we just zeroed in on a convenient Saturday afternoon, which happened to be when Judas Priest were playing, at the nearby arena called the Capitol Center. We just went out there, paid admission to the parking lot with my borrowed gear from the studio, and wandered around for 2 hours, did not go to the concert, went back to my studio with just an hour's worth of tape, which is not very much, and as soon as I saw it, the title popped into my head, Heavy Metal Parking Lot. And we both, you know, have shared in this journey, which is nearing 25 years, in 2011.
And you know, I've read that you were a little apprehensive maybe about approaching bikers at first, but things turned out to really be the opposite.
Exactly. People really were falling all over themselves to be on camera, in some cases literally because they were inebriated. But we did not have any preconceived agenda making this. We knew that it would be a colorful scene based on, you know, the culture of the times and certainly our own concert-going experiences. Neither John or I were into heavy metal, but we were not dismissive of it. We certainly appreciated what it was and certainly had been fans and knew fan behavior and knew concert-going behavior. So we went, just with open eyes and open ears, and but with some trepidation because I was responsible for this equipment, so I took the liberty. We thought, well, gee, we might capture some nefarious behavior, but it was far from the case. Everybody was very friendly and accommodating.
Talk about the generation gap a little bit. How old are you?
21.
19. What can I say?
What do you guys think? You're young or a little old to be here?
Look at these other two Bobby, man. We've been coming up priest every
younger
year.
Younger crowd here, now. Man. Used to be an older crowd. Man. This is the sixth time I've seen the priest.
Oh, yeah?
It's probably the first time, mostly. You know.
Yeah.
Before we get focus on other work of yours, I think Sofia Coppola really had a role in inspiring you to stay with this parking lot theme years later.
Indirectly, she did. We basically showed Heavy Metal Parking Lot to our friends and in the Washington area quite a bit, and this was in an era and a time when tape trading was kind of in its peak, I guess. I mean, the home video revolution was in full swing. Home video, everybody had VCRs, and people were trading material. We never conceived of Heavy Metal Parking Lot as a commercial property. We basically gave it out to friends and arranged screenings. We were a victim of bad timing because in these days, theaters show video. You can go to a movie theater and see video projected on a screen. It's very much the norm. But back then, you could not see video in theaters. So we just had to rely on home screenings on television and then giving it out to record stores and friends. And who knows, that's how it really got distributed, was just by tape trading. Well, eventually, around 1990, this was 4 years after we made it, we stopped showing it. We felt it had run its course, and we went on to other things, mainly our lives, careers, what have you. Well, somewhere around 1994, John actually got a phone call out of the blue from Sofia Coppola, who introduced herself and said she was making a television show for Comedy Central and that she wanted to use Heavy Metal Parking Lot. That was the first indication that we had actually any notice or awareness outside of Washington, our home base, Washington, D.C., Maryland. And so that was quite a shock. She had rented it from a store called Mondo Video A Go-Go. I guess at that time it was in the Silver Lake district of Los Angeles. We called up Mondo Video. You know, they couldn't have been more friendly and happy that we had tracked them down. John called them and found out that not only had Sofia Coppola rented it, but many other celebrities and personalities and musicians had been renting it. And what happened was that was our first inclination that people were aware of it, and it was spreading around and had been traded and, you know, circulated virally, much like things are done now. But this was back when you had to actually physically copy the tape. Now it's all just done on the internet in a matter of seconds. So that's how Sofia Coppola got it. Nothing happened, unfortunately, with the television show. But whether she knows it or not, she helped, you know, really get us going again and really move into franchise territory. Because when we realized that it had some legs, we started to, we dusted off the concept and wound up making a sequel in 1996. 10 years later, it was Neil Diamond Parking Lot. And then we were off and running.
Are you happy to say that's what you're known for, or are you concerned that this kind of shuns the fact that you've done other work?
Well, I've got, you know, it's tops on my resume. I mean, you got to lead with your strengths, and whatever you're known for, you kind of go with. And in that case, I think we've made an effort to, capitalize on that.
Heavy Metal Parking Lot, Neil Diamond, Harry Potter, Cher, I believe.
Well, what happened was, along the way, we've had some great opportunities to, capitalize on what we did. And like I say, the name recognition. One thing that happened around 2003, we got contacted by somebody who wanted to rep the concept of Parking Lot as a television series. Out of the blue, they contacted us, which was very flattering. And they were able to sell the concept to a network called Trio, which was actually like a sister channel to Bravo. It was called the Pop Culture Network, and they actually let us do a limited series called Parking Lot. And sadly, both the series and the network were short-lived. I recently posted some of the television clips for the parking lots on YouTube so that you can see them. And there are things like Cher parking lot, Yanni parking lot, professional wrestling parking lot, and on and on.
Well, you also seek out strange characters in the D.C. area. I mean, I assume largely in the D.C. area. I mean, just some really obscure personalities. I mean, that's another part of your resume.
Well, that's a good, that's flattering. I have obscure personalities. I like that. In fact, I've often been called a nut magnet, which, not only do I seek people out, I'm kind of like, they're attracted to me. And so it's a mutual thing. And luckily, I've managed to find people who are comfortable on camera, and I tend to, if people are entertaining and colorful, they frequently find themselves in front of my lens at some point, and I make a short video.
I'd say the biggest project you have in terms of star power is Ernest Borgnine on the Bus. The guy is going strong. He's 92 years old. He appeared on the final episode of ER and got an Emmy nomination for it. And he was just a parade marshal on Columbus Day in Chicago. I got to know how you were able to get lined up to make that film. And was it something that was pitched to him, or how did that whole thing come about?
Well, I had the good fortune to be employed by Discovery Channel for 5 years, where I really got to learn the nuts and bolts of television programming and creating TV for networks, and that was from 90 to 95. And during that time, I became close friends with another person there who had the same kind of kooky sensibilities for television and documentary that I do, a guy named Brendan Conway. And Brendan and I just used to kind of come up with TV show ideas that we would like to see. Now, mind you, this is a good 5 years before reality television craze got launched with the Osbournes on MTV. So we're talking like 93. We had heard that Ernest Borgnine, because we loved celebrity culture, but kind of B-celebrity, not A-list necessarily, and we heard that Ernest Borgnine, who many people thought wasn't around anymore, but that he was he's somewhat in retirement, but that he traveled around the country in a bus, driving the bus, and being a retiree, a whimsical retiree with a gigantic bus that he was piloting. I think he might have gone on Regis and Kathy Lee, or perhaps been written up in the a tabloid, which is how we found out about it. So Brendan and I thought, what a hilarious idea for a show, just Ernest Borgnine driving around and people seeing him, driving a bus. And you could pick up people he starred with, or do like a film history and Hollywood history, and also like Charles Kuralt on the road type of thing, but with Ernest Borgnine. So this is how we kind of came up with this notion, but one day we were like, I dare you to call Ernest Borgnine. I forget who dared who, but I know I wound up tracking down his agent and then making a pitch. And the fact that we worked at Discovery Channel certainly helped. It was not going to be something Discovery would necessarily want, but we used that to at least leverage ourselves. And we wound up having a meeting at the Plaza Hotel in New York to pitch him. And it was great. He was wonderful. Great guy. And very interested, and had even thought about doing something like this himself. So that kind of just got the ball rolling, and eventually we had to somehow, pony up to get a footage in the can to create a demo reel, because nobody understood what we were talking about. And that's why I was able to go spend a week in the summer of 95 with a film crew following him around the Midwest.
You mean Ernie's got a bus? Yeah. So what? Who drives it for him? He does. What? He drives a bus? He's got to be crazy. Yeah, they all think I'm a little off, but hey, listen, I'm having the time of my life.
I got enough in the can during that 1 week to, create a demo reel, and then ultimately when we couldn't sell the concept still as a series, I had enough for a documentary. And that's how I have Ernest Borgnine on the bus. And I still keep in touch with him and his son, and he's doing great. And God bless him.
Well, talk about back on what you're most known for, Heavy Metal Picnic. When this is completed, what will we expect to see?
Well, one of my latest projects is something called Heavy Metal Picnic. Again, I'm back to my roots, back to where it all began, Heavy Metal Parking Lot. I'm not ashamed to be exploiting that and making what's, I guess, maybe could be considered a prequel. Because what happened was several years ago, a buddy of mine said that he had footage of a heavy metal party, of a rock party in a field in Maryland where these heavy metal bands were playing, and he had brought a camera, and he was a fan of the music, and he basically wandered around with a home video camera and had all this footage. And as I've come to know, his footage is really key, especially when you have footage from a time when there's not that much footage, because nobody had cameras, and cell phones with cameras didn't exist, and digital cameras didn't exist. So having footage is special when it stands out from that time in the mid-80s. And in this case, it was footage of a Maryland field party. What was this kind of bacchanal that was taped by somebody who was a part of that scene. And they actually had like a stolen CBS microphone flag that one of the guys had taken from one of the Reagan inaugurals where he was a security guard. And they're wandering around with the CBS microphone in this party and taping it. And it's pretty absurd. And what I've done is gone and, you know, interviewed people who were involved in it, interviewed people who went to these parties, interviewed the people who had the parties. And it's not just about the party. It's kind of about the whole scene. And I found other footage from other parties. So it's called Heavy Metal Picnic, and I'm aiming to have it ready next spring, which will be the 25th anniversary of when they had this big two-day party known as the Full Moon Jamboree in Maryland in 1985. And it's funny because it was such a big party that the news crews came out. So I have a news story. There were newspaper articles about it because you got to realize this party was taking place around all these mansions. It was in a real Tony area called Potomac, Maryland. But yet they still had these farmhouses, and a bunch of these local guys had rented this farmhouse, and that became like Party Central. And that's where they had this big party, and so I'm building a whole documentary out of it and calling it Heavy Metal Picnic.
You haven't done the festival thing for a while, but it might be see you on that kind of circuit again with this movie.
Well, I sure hope so. That's what I'm aiming for. I'm hoping it will happen. I mean, the problem, if it is a problem, although it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it just makes it that much more competitive, is that there's a lot of content out there, a lot of projects, a lot of documentaries, a lot of just programming for very small slots. So if you go to any film festival and ask them, I mean, that's an interesting thing to explore if you're interested, is these film festivals get, you know, oftentimes 50 times more submissions than what they can program, 100 times more. 2,000 films can get submitted to a major festival for only 100 slots. So a lot of good films don't get in and don't get seen. And that's just the reality of it, and I understand and accept that. So I'm just hoping for the best with this.
Jeff Bosser talked to cult documentary filmmaker Jeff Krulik. Much of his work can be found online through websites like YouTube and jeffkrulik.com. One of his most recent films is one of several profiles he's done on particular subjects in the Washington, D.C., Maryland area. The Legend of Merv Khan tracks a singing and strolling accordion player and a career that spanned more than 70 years. Let's hear a sample from Khan's 1,000-song repertoire. We'll be right back. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to wilo.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.